So our subject for this evening is the economy, and I was very struck recently by an article I read in the Evening Standard newspaper. It was reporting on a meeting held in a London church to discuss issues surrounding the upcoming general election. And it was generally very positive. It was positive about the event. It was positive about the church engaging with the political debates. But it went on to say this. It said that with so many clergy, so many church people present, of course, naturally, there was no discussion of the national debt, no discussion of the deficit, no discussion of the economy in general. The assumption of the writer, and they assumed that everyone else reading it would be the same, is that the church has nothing at all to say about issues of the economy. And I began to wonder, is that true? Does the Christian faith have nothing to say about this subject of the economy? Does God's word have no word to us on financial matters? Should following Jesus and shaping economic policy always be kept completely apart? Well, if we think about it, economics is at the heart all about how we grow and how we use wealth, both nationally and personally. And I think, looking around us, it's quite likely that none of us here particularly would consider themselves to be wealthy. I wouldn't have thought I would label myself that. If you're a student here this evening, it's great to have you. I can't imagine anyone who's in university would say, yeah, I'm really quite wealthy. But the fact of the matter is, compared to most of the world's population, almost everyone here is fantastically wealthy. We have a huge amount of resources at our disposal. And if we have money, however little, to earn or to spend or to save, we are involved, whether we like it or not, in our economic life. And as we open the pages of the Bible, far from being silent on the matter of money, the Bible has an enormous amount to say about how we use, how we view, how we think about money and about wealth. Far from economic policy, the Bible is full of issues surrounding money and our use and indeed our abuse of it. So what was the motivation behind that writer in the Evening Standard? What might be the motivation behind us if we think, well, frankly, as we talk about the upcoming election, as we talk with friends and colleagues, we might have nothing to say about the subject of the economy? I think the answer lies in how difficult the economy is for us to grasp. It is, after all, an enormous subject. And again, let's face it, most of us struggle to get a handle on our own meager finances, to know how much money we've got coming in, how much we've got in the bank, whether we can pay our bills or not, so let alone to have anything worthwhile to say about them on a national scale. If I can't work out how much I owe, how on earth can I say anything about how much the country owes? In the recent TV interview between Evan Davis and David Cameron, they touched on a number of different subjects, including the economy. And the Prime Minister, as he spoke, tried to talk about figures, but Evan Davis kept telling him, look, frankly, you are bamboozling me with numbers. And maybe that's how we feel as we think about the economy. All this talk of GDP and fiscal spending and inflation, deflation and quantitative easing all conspire to make our heads spin. My head has been spinning this week as I've been preparing this. I haven't been able to keep it in my mind. And it doesn't help that each political party, of course, has its own particular spin on the figures, its own interpretation of the numbers, its own view of how they should be shaped. Elections are made of sound bites, and the economy is rarely explained in a simple sentence or two. The recent Institute of Fiscal Studies report, which analyzed the economic plans of the Conservatives, Labour, Liberal Democrats, and SNP, concluded this, that unfortunately the electorate is at best armed with only an incomplete picture of what they can expect from any of these four main parties. So I don't know how on earth I'm going to do any justice to such a complex subject in the short time that we have this evening. And yet, it is true that the Bible talks so much about money, therefore it is important to consider how we as Christians should think about the economy. Not just because the UK is the fifth biggest economy in the world, depending on how you work the figures out, with London being tied with New York as the world's financial capital, but also because the economy affects people personally. from shaping how easy it is for us to find a job to how much we might earn when we have one, from how your savings grow to whether on earth we can ever look forward to someday buying a property. Now, let me tell you up front, I haven't yet decided how I'm going to vote at the general election. But as I've been thinking about this, I am convinced that decisions around the economy are vital ones to shape not just how we vote, but how we think and how we speak and how we act politically, whether you're able to vote in this general election or not. So let me try, and in the time we've got together, draw out a few points from God's word, and particularly anchored in this passage from Mark chapter 12. What are we to say about the economy as we think about it? Well, the first thing is this, that we should contribute to the economy. We should contribute to the economy. In our passage from Mark chapter 12, the Pharisees and Herodians team up to try and trap Jesus. They want to ask a question that will trip him up. They are, to be honest, a rather unusual partnership, but they're willing to form a coalition in order to challenge Jesus and to attempt to silence him. Why? Because they're angered about Jesus' criticism of them, particularly his criticism that they've seen and heard in the parable at the beginning of this chapter. And it's interesting that the way that they choose to challenge Jesus, the question that they choose to pose to him, is at heart an economic one. It is a question about taxation. And their questioning could have come from the Today program, couldn't it? Teacher, they say, we know that you are a man of integrity. You can just imagine John Humphreys or Kirsty Walk buttering up the politician of the day, giving them that sort of easy way in order to sideswipe them with a black and white yes or no question. Is it right to pay the poll tax to Caesar or not? Should we pay or shouldn't we? Don't beat around the bush, politician. It's a straight answer, yes or no. Come on, minister. Don't evade it. Don't get any way around it. Give us an answer. Give us a straight answer. Come on, yes or no. Yes or no. But here's the thing. Unlike many politicians under the steely gaze of someone like Jeremy Paxman, Jesus does answer the question. And he answers in a way that surprises and amazes those who listen. You see, the religious leaders who posed the question were expecting one of two answers. If Jesus said yes to paying the tax, well, he would lose the support of the Jewish population who resented Roman occupying rule. But on the other hand, if he said no, he would be in direct opposition to Rome and would face their retribution. But instead, Jesus' answer is both subtle and powerful. Turning to his questioners, he asks them for a denarius, a coin, and he says to them, whose image is this? Whose inscription is on this coin? Well, for them, it's an easy question to answer. Caesar's, they reply. So says Jesus, give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. Now, what is initially surprising about Jesus' answer is that he affirms the paying of taxes. There's an uncomfortable truth for us. We don't like paying taxes. We don't like that idea of earning money and then a chunk of it being taken away. But here, Jesus says, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. And this is in the context of Roman taxes that weren't exactly a modern welfare state. Oh yeah, the people of Jesus' day might have been able to find some answers to the question, what have the Romans done for us? Aqueducts and roads and sewers and, well, they could come up with a whole bunch of things. But the Roman taxes that they were forced to pay weren't going to directly help and support the poor and the marginalized of Jewish society. And yet Jesus affirms the paying of taxes. Since you live under Roman rule, since you carry around Roman coins, they didn't have to hunt around very long to find a denarius, well, then you should pay Roman taxes. Well, we too live in a society where we have the opportunity to contribute to the economy, and we should do so as we can. A significant portion of that is through taxation. And so it is right and good and proper for Christians to pay their taxes. It's not fun. It's not necessarily easy. We don't find it pleasant, but it does help others. It is right and proper. And indeed, we should be involved in the political debate to ensure a fair system of taxation where we can. And for many, an opportunity to contribute to the economy also comes not just through taxation, but also through work. The Bible again and again affirms the positive nature of work, of the goodness of earning your own food to eat, as the Apostle Paul puts it in 2 Thessalonians. Indeed, many people here this evening are not able to vote in this upcoming general election. You're not perhaps a British citizen, and therefore you don't have a vote in this country, but back in your home country. But the UK economy depends on the work that you do and the contribution you provide. We should contribute to the economy. And of course, not everyone is able to contribute through work, through employment, as they would want to. So part of good economic policy is to provide opportunities for employment to allow all who want to play a part in the economy through the work that they do. So there's the first point that Jesus affirms here, that we should contribute to the economy. But if the first part of Jesus' answer is immensely practical, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, the second part is deeply profound. Give to God what is God's. And so we need also to remember that the economy belongs to God. You see, if we are to pay our taxes because we live in a certain economy, for Jesus' day, in the Roman economy, well, then we should also give back to God what belongs to him, what belongs to his economy. And so that leads us to the question, what belongs to God? And the answer the Bible gives us is very clear indeed. Everything. Everything belongs to God. Psalm 24, verse 1 says it very plainly. The earth is the Lord's, and everything in it. You'd think the first part of that verse would do it, wouldn't you? The earth is the Lord's. But in case we're thinking of wheeling it out, of finding a loophole, and everything in it, everything is God's. God created all things. All things come from him, and so all things belong to him. And that includes our economy, and it includes each one of us too. This is a basic fact that runs all the way through the Bible. And it has important implications for how we think about and how we view and how we speak about economic issues. But here's the first implication. The economy cannot save us. The economy cannot save us. You see, you might be led to think that by the political discourse, by the way in which politicians talk about economic issues during an election as well as other times. You see, if only if this economic factor was brought under control or this issue dealt with, then all would be well and our society would flourish. Well, understanding and directing our economy is important for those in government and for each one of us, but we must not be tempted to believe that economics alone can save us or save the world or the country we live in. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, put it this way in a recent book. He said, there is a general social assumption that the economy has the power to dictate what is and is not possible for human beings. We believe that if we can fix the economy, the fixing of human beings will automatically follow. That is a lie. So whether we believe in a large state with the power and resources to give welfare to many, or a small state giving power and resources back into the hands of individuals, whichever way we think is the right economic direction to go, we need to remember that everything belongs to God. It is his. And so a right relationship with our economy only comes truly with a right relationship to the God it belongs to. The economy cannot save us. And secondly, people are more than economic indicators. Again, it's very easy when talking about the economy to reduce people to numbers and to statistics. Whether it's the money that they contribute or earn or the welfare that they need, human beings simply become perhaps a point on a chart or a number on a page. You see how Jesus confronts these Pharisees and Herodians. He asks them for a coin, and he says of the coin, whose image is this? He could equally have pointed to them and asked this very same thing. Whose image is on you? And they would have to answer, not Caesar, but God. You see, God has put his image and his inscription on us. And that means we belong to God. And that means that every human being is made in God's image to reflect his glory. And so we should be wary of any economic discussion that reduces people from God's image bearers to statistical data or monetary information alone. People are more than economic indicators. And all of this leads to another important point for us to consider. If the economy is indeed God's economy, if it belongs to him, then we are responsible and accountable to God for the way in which we use the resources he has given us. As we think in the midst of this election, whether we're able to vote in this election or not, what can we say about the economy? How can we enter into that debate and that conversation? Well, then we need to say we are stewards of God's economy. We are stewards of God's economy. This is true. This is important for us to think about, whether we're eligible to vote in a general election here or not. Wherever we live, whichever economy we are part of, we are called to be responsible to God for the way we use what he has given us. We are to be stewards. We are to be good stewards, responsible stewards of what he has placed in our hands. Whether that's our own bank balances or the massive wheels of the national economy, it is God's, and we use it to glorify him. After the economic crash in 2008, the General Synod of the Church of England put forward three principles that mark out what they see as stewarding God's economy well. I think, actually, they're very, very helpful. They're worthwhile for us to consider, to shape our prayers for our politicians and for our countries, and our actions, both in public finances and our personal ones as well. Here's what they had to say. The first is that the economy should be sustainable. We need to ask ourselves and ask our political parties, are we pursuing policies and actions to develop the economy in ways that ensure resources are available not just for now, not just for me, not just lining my own pockets, but also for the future. Ways that ensure growth, since some growth, it would seem, are necessary for a healthy economy, but not just growth at all costs. And in particular, this will mean ensuring our politicians pursue policies that get to grips with the issue of debt. The size of public borrowing is the kind of number that you just simply struggle to get your head around. They're the kind of numbers that people use in astronomy rather than in banking, it would seem. The country's deficit, that is the gap between money coming in and money being spent, is around £100 billion a year. And that's led to our national debt, the amount that as a country, the UK, owes, moving from £500 billion in 2008 to £1.4 trillion in 2014. I don't know about you, I cannot simply get my head round what £1.4 trillion looks like. I try to imagine it in sort of stacks of £20 notes, and my head explodes. In case your head explodes as well, that simply means in the time, the 6 years between 2008 and 2014, our national debt has tripled. And this is a real issue. It's an important issue. It's a real issue to building a sustainable economy that will be healthy for future generations, not just reaping the rewards now and it doesn't matter what happens tomorrow. Not burdening our children and their children with crippling interest repayments. And it's also important because our reliance on debt and borrowing is reflected in our personal lives as well. As we see that in our country's affairs, so we can easily mirror it in our own affairs. I was very struck that the amount of personal debt in this country is about the same level as the national debt. That is, as people, we owe collectively £1.4 trillion. That is nearly £30,000 for every adult in the UK. Stephen has already mentioned that the Old Testament people of God had this principle of Jubilee written by God into their national life. Every generation, debts will be written off, property returned to families, ensuring each generation was not burdened by the past economic issues. It's not easy to work out what this might look like in a society today. But if we are to say anything about the economy under God, then we need to say it's not all about me and what benefits my bank balance or lines my pockets, but about having an economy that is sustainable for the future. Here's the second point, that our economy needs also to be fair. That is, do the policies and actions around the economy benefit one group of people more than the others? Does it affect one place or one area to the expense or detriment of other places and areas? That means if we are going to engage in the economy, if we're going to think about this from a Christian point of view, it means looking beyond our immediate situation and practicing empathy, of putting ourselves in the shoes of others and seeing things from their point of view. If we live in London, which is probably most of us here this evening, then it's easy to see the economy through the lens of London life, which isn't necessarily reflected in the rest of the country or the rest of the world. London has its own set of issues and problems, of course, but some aspects of economic policy can look quite different in Cumbria from Canary Wharf. Again, as I was thinking about this subject this week, I was very struck by the fact that since the economic crash of 2008, average property prices in London have gone up by a third. But in that same time, average property prices in Northern Ireland have been slashed by a half. Different places are affected in different ways. And if we are to be fair, we need to think about how these policies affect everyone, not just me. And fairness hits at the heart of viewing the economy as God's economy. The worker deserves his wages, say both Jesus and the Apostle Paul. But inequality, unfairness can hit wages from zero-hour contracts to the level of the minimum wage. But actually, I can't escape the issue of fairness in my own economic dealings either. The call to be fair hits me personally, and I have to ask, am I fair in the use of my money and my resources? From my honesty in paying taxes to the fairness of my actions, whether as an employee or perhaps as an employer. If we say anything to people as we discuss this election and the issues surrounding it, then we need to say that this economy is God's economy, so it needs to be fair. And then thirdly, the economy needs also to be generous. Just think for a moment how most economic decisions are sold to us by political parties. Almost invariably, they're geared to our own self-interests. How this policy will benefit me, what extra I will get, how my taxes will go down, how my benefits will go up, how much money I will gain. And it's not difficult to see why. It gets them votes. We respond to that, to our own self-interest. But the Christian view of life, as Paul explains to the Philippian church, means not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of the others. So here we have a wonderful opportunity as Christians to stand against the tide of economic discussion and say that policies and decisions need to be driven by generosity, and in particular, a concern for those who are poor and needy. When the welfare state was created, it was created in response to the 1942 Beveridge Report. And in that report, they called the government to combat what was called the five great evils. They were want, disease, ignorance, squalor, and idleness. Or if you wanted in more modern terms, to be generous in tackling issues of poverty, health, education, housing, and employment. Those five haven't gone away yet, nor will they until Christ returns. And until that day, we need to make sure that we are generous. You see, states and governments are in unique positions to help those who are most vulnerable, those most in need, in ways that individuals such as you and I, or even communities, simply aren't able to do. But we need to promote, encourage, and approach the economy that is general rather than self-seeking, that is generous. And for that, we will need God's help and grace. But just as we may call our governments to be generous, so we must hear the call of God to be generous ourselves. I've been very interested to find out that there have been Christians in the past who have stood against a large welfare state, not because they didn't care for the poor, that they were uninformed or unengaged. No, they included amongst them people like Lord Shaftesbury. It was because they were worried that letting the state care for the needy removed our own sense of responsibility to look after those in need. And the fact of the matter is, whoever is elected after this general election, the state of the economy means that more responsibility is likely to fall on individuals, on communities, on churches, to care for those most in need. But whatever your view of the size of the state and the level of welfare spending, we each one of us have a call on our lives to live generously. To live generously in the way that we act as well as the way that we're politically active. As we finish, come back with me again to Mark chapter 12. Do you see Jesus' shrewdness, his wisdom here? As the Pharisees and Herodians question him, we're told in verse 15, but Jesus knew their hypocrisy. You see, we can often point the finger and point out the hypocrisy of others, most often politicians as well as Pharisees. But let us not forget that Jesus knows our own hearts too. And as we call for our politicians to shape an economy that's sustainable, that's fair, that's generous, let us not call our politicians to do something that we are unwilling to do ourselves. If you're able to vote, don't just use your vote for fairness and generosity as an excuse not to be fair and generous yourself. But let us be fair and generous in our dealing with others and our own use of money as well as our political power. Yes, let's call our government to account since they belong to God, but let's not forget that we follow a generous God who gave up the glory of heaven to come as a human being, to live on earth as a man and to die on a cruel Roman cross. There is no depth of generosity deeper than that. This is the God who says to us, follow me. So let's follow him as generous people in our votes, in our political action, and in every aspect of our lives. Let us ask God for the work of his Spirit in our hearts to give to Caesar what is Caesar's, but to give to God what is God's, which is everything. Well, let's use our final song as a prayer. The God himself, the Lord Jesus Christ, would fill our gaze, fill our vision, so that that vision of our Lord supreme in our heart would direct all of our ways, including our money, including our votes. Let's stand and sing.